Welcome to Studio 2. I'm Cherry Gregg, back from vacation. It's so nice to see you.
It's wonderful to see you, Cherry. Hello, I'm Avi Wolf from Inerrant. We are so glad to have you back. We missed you.
I missed you too.
We hope you're rested, rejuvenated, but we're not going to ease you back into it. We got a busy show today, okay?
Let's jump in.
Okay, coming up today, we're talking about tipping. That little gratuity inspires a lot of big feelings. We know some of you feel a bit put on the spot these days thanks to the growing number of businesses that suggest a tip when you're making a purchase. It is not just restaurants anymore.
No, the pandemic was a good time to leave a heavy tip for struggling service workers, and the switch to cashless at a lot of establishments has changed the way we tip and even who gets a tip. We want you to weigh in on our tipflation conversation by emailing studio2@whyy.org. You can also call us. The number is 888-477-9499.
Before we get there, in just a few minutes, we're talking about the LGBTQ plus community in Philly in particular, whether folks are moving here because of laws in their home states. And later, at the end of the hour, a conversation about Charles Bloxon, who passed away this month. But first, Cherry, you remember this part.
Yes.
We're going to round up some news.
Yes, we like to dig in, and you have the shovel first.
That's going to become a thing, I can tell. So the weather in our region, yo-yo type of summer so far, was very dry in May. It was the driest May on record in Philadelphia. We received less than a quarter inch of rain here. And now recently we're stuck in this, I shouldn't say stuck, we're in this pattern of very humid weather with lots of moisture, and it seems every day there's the chance of flooding, heavy rainstorms. What do you make of it, Cherry?
Well, you know, last night was kind of crazy. Mm-hmm. I woke up, thunder, lightning, all of that, lots of rain. But it was interesting because Vox.com did a whole explainer on why this happens. Because of climate change. Yeah, because of climate change, it's getting warmer. And so the atmosphere can absorb more moisture. And because it takes longer for it to rain, because it has to absorb more moisture, when it does rain, it dumps a ton of rain on us, and because of that, we tend to flood a little bit.
So you have the drought-flood dichotomy.
Drought-flood, drought-flood, it goes back and forth.
It's always hard to talk about these types of things because we always track back to it's because of climate change, and I think people start to tune it out, although it is because of climate change. So
yeah, because the warmer you get, there are repercussions and consequences to the excessive warmth.
Yeah, so in Delaware, they're doing something that is sort of to prevent climate change and other types of environmental degradation. Give us a little preview.
Yeah, a styro ban. It just passed both the state house and the state senate in Delaware. And it means that the first state will join other states like New Jersey in banning some single-use products that are harmful to the environment. And the main focus, of course, is styrofoam. But they're also taking on plastic coffee stirrers, you remember those?
Mm-hmm.
Cocktail and sandwich picks, and plastic straws will now only be available unless a customer specifically asks for one. Now, all of this is because folks say that production of styrofoam specifically is bad for air quality, and it's one of the most littered items, according to some state lawmakers in the state of Delaware. And so that's one of the reasons why they're trying to ban this. Now, hold bones. It's not going to happen overnight. 2025 is when this ban would go into effect. But we're seeing movements. I was on vacation. They didn't have those little, you know, those little drink umbrellas. Cocktail umbrellas. They didn't even have them because they said that environmentally it was better to not have them. So we see a big shift now to the little things that could, you know, help with our environment.
Yeah, it's happening.
Yeah,
whether people want it to happen or not. Obviously, you might expect some businesses are not thrilled about this. Mm-hmm. A lot of businesses have shifted a lot of their business to takeout now if they're food entrepreneurs, and styrofoam is cheap. I won't miss it. I know that.
You can't even put it in a microwave.
Yeah, styrofoam I find to be one of the most offensive materials you can put anything in. Mm-hmm. I hate the sound of it. I hate it when it's used as a packing material. And the fact that it's bad for the environment should kind of put the nail in the coffin for me personally, although I am sensitive to the fact that businesses, this is a cost for them. hopefully the fact that all the businesses have to take on this cost at the same time will sort of even out the effect.
Yeah, and I will mention that there are some exceptions to the rule. Hospitals can still use styrofoam. You know, they're the only ones that kind of fall out of this area. And we see other states, New Jersey, a lot of municipalities are doing the same thing, like Westchester and Narberth. So, I mean, it's happening, like you said. And I thought about the sound of styrofoam. It's like, you know, fingernails on a chalkboard to
me.
It's worse than that for me.
Yeah. I would scratch a million chalkboards before I rub two pieces of styrofoam together.
It is a curdling sound.
Well, you don't need to worry about styrofoam at the buffet.
Ooh.
Because you can't take anything home with you. That's the deal of the buffet, right?
All you can eat
while you're there.
Yep. While you're in the seat.
We were amused by a New York Times article recently that says buffets are back because in the pandemic, of course, buffets took a big hit. People were not exactly looking for that type of dining experience while a virus was raging. But apparently, in the last year or so, there's been a big rebound in buffets' fortunes. So good thing, bad thing. How you feel?
Well, Avi, you're getting to know me very well over these past few weeks. I'm not a big buffet person, and I specifically do not like buffets that are by doors.
What?
Yeah, like if a buffet entryway. And the air is shifting and people walking in, bringing, you know, like bad air from outside and funk, all that kind of stuff. I have a problem with it. Like, and I'm keeping it real with you right now because
Our guest we haven't turned to yet in the studio is about to lose it. Doing a fantastic job not losing it.
I mean, because the dirt coming from outside, you by the door, like people walking in, you know, smoke. I don't know. Like, I just feel some kind of way about buffets by doors. So I'm not going to be running back. And if there is a buffet, it needs to be in a special room away from the outside.
Like in a hermetically sealed chamber. That's the only way we're going. Interesting. I don't have deep thoughts about buffets. I like them, I guess. Buffets, I enjoy going to them. There was one buffet I went to as a kid over and over. Whenever my grandparents came to town, we always went to this one buffet, a brunch buffet, and I have fond memories of that.
Aww.
I'm trying to remember if it was near a door. I don't know, but I survived somehow.
Look, when you go to a buffet next, you're going to be like, you know what? Mm-hmm. This is by the door, and you're gonna feel what I feel. Sorry.
I doubt that. I seriously doubt that. Okay. Let's shift to our newsmaker interview for the day. Actually, want to tie this back to the state of Delaware, which we just mentioned. State Senator Sarah McBride announced Monday that she is running for a U.S. House seat, and she would become, if she wins, the first openly transgender person to hold an elected federal position. She's already the country's highest-ranking transgender elected official, which may indicate that some states are becoming more supportive or accepting of trans people. Others, however, are not. In Texas alone, more than 55 bills were introduced aiming to regulate gender identity and expression. Four of them passed, regulating aspects of sports, education, healthcare, and cultural performances.
Yeah, and our next guest says some trans people no longer feel safe in their hometowns, and they're hoping to find a better life elsewhere in the United States. And certain states introduced these trans refugee bills aiming to become a safe haven for trans people. Now, while Pennsylvania has not passed such a bill, Philadelphia could become a spot for LGBT and specifically T refugees. And we have Tyrell Brown, executive director of Galay, here today. They were a panelist for WHYY's event, City of Love, Philly's Role in the LGBTQ plus rights movement. Tyrell, welcome to Studio 2.
Hi, everyone. How are you?
Yes, we're excited to have you here. So you spoke about an influx of LGBTQ plus folks to Philadelphia since the introduction of anti-trans legislation in states like Florida and Texas. What have you seen on the ground?
You know, at our organization, our doors are open for resources for everyone. But what we did witness over the last 2 months was that there were people that were reaching out to us from Florida that were like, we're moving up here. And so we started to work very quickly to make sure that there was housing, housing options and opportunities for them up here. Unfortunately, like right now in Philadelphia as well, like we don't do an adequate job of taking care of our own people in many facets. So it's especially people that are pushed furthest to the margins, the queer and trans community here in Philadelphia. So we've been working kind of trying to weave this and make sure that we are taking the onset need on as well as taking care of people here in Philadelphia. I think just after that, I had read a poll that was by Data for Progress, and it said that 8% of trans people in the country have already migrated or moved, which people are like, 8%, that's not a lot, but that's not a lot, but that's like a 250,000 people that have already moved from their states, and another 43% in that poll said that they were considering doing so. And we're not talking just about state to state. People are leaving their individual municipalities because their individual municipalities are unsafe or unsupportive or not affirming.
Can you just, backtracking a bit, explain to folks what your organization does, mm-hmm. and why you're sort of at the mesh point of this issue?
So GLAE is a radical social justice organization. We call ourselves radical because I think what we seek and what we want to affirm and give to people is something that seems pretty normal, which is equity and justice. But in the face of such radical acts as legislation coming down and oppressing us, it does seem radical to love freely and liberate love for people. So, but we do direct services for the queer and trans community. Our organization was founded back in 1989 by David Acosta, who founded it as the Gay and Lesbian AIDS Education Initiative, which was primarily and focused on serving the Latinx community and getting resources at the height of the HIV and AIDS crisis. So we have four programs at GLAE. One is the TINGS program, which stands for Trans, Intersex, Non-Binary, and Gender Nonconforming Services. A lot of acronyms here. Then there's the POT program that's prioritizing our people, which does prevention and education around HIV. And then we have our SPLAT program, which is our youth program, that's student power, leadership, and activism together. And then we also have Pride 365, which produces large-scale events like Pride and National Coming Out Day as well in Philadelphia.
Yeah, I think that's wonderful. I want to just back up and I guess zoom out a little bit and talk about Philadelphia generally and some of its history, because I think back 2003, Philly was one of the first cities to launch a major marketing campaign. It's called Get Your History Straight and Your Nightlife Gay. And it's been almost 20 years now since that launched. So is this an opportunity with these anti-trans bills? Is this an opportunity for a city like Philadelphia? And what are you guys going to do to sort of seize the day?
Absolutely. I mean, I think Philadelphia is a city of first, and it's the opportunity is there for us to do something big, to do something transformative, to do something resourceful, restorative for the queer and trans community here, and then as well as making sure that it's an attractive and safe and sound place for people around the nation to look upon us, to come to us for resources as well, even in the tri-state, tri-county area. So I think we can be that beacon of hope, and I think the moment is now for us to come together and do that at all levels of opportunity right now.
Well, that is Tyrell Brown. They are the executive director of GLAE. Thanks so much for joining us on Studio 2. Coming up, Jerry.
Yeah, when to tip and when to skip. Join the conversation about tipping etiquette by emailing studio2@whyy.org. You can call us also 888-477-9499. Avi, we're looking forward to that conversation.
Supporting WHYY, Penn Medicine, helping to find new cures for cancer. With life-saving clinical trials and advanced surgical techniques, Penn Medicine is offering more hope for patients everywhere. Learn more at pennmedicine.org/cancer. Penn Medicine, what's next?
And welcome back to Studio 2, everybody. I'm Avi Wolfman.
And I'm Cherry Gregg. Are you as confused as I am about when to tip and how much to tip and also who to tip, right? Every purchase we make, even at a fast food or self-serve restaurant, we are asked to leave a tip now.
And we all know that moment, Cherry, when the tablet swivels your direction with three options, 15%, 20%, 25%, $1, $2, $3. The employee is looking at you.
Pressure.
The person behind you probably doesn't care, but they could be looking over your shoulder and judging you for whatever choice you make. Of course, we all like to think we're generous people, but how much should we tip the person who poured your coffee into a paper cup and handed it to you?
Well, we are not alone feeling a little confused because a recent survey by Bankrate shows that Americans are growing more annoyed by gratuity requests. One in three say it has gotten out of hand, and people are starting to tip less. University of Pennsylvania marketing professor Kate Lamberton is here with us to talk about what's been called tipflation, why it's happening, and how to think about it. Kate Lamberton, welcome to Studio 2.
So happy to be here.
And we want to hear from you folks. Are you confused or annoyed by tipping requests? Maybe you don't mind. Maybe you want to tip a lot. Call us. The number is 888-477-9499. You can also email studio2@whyy.org. Kate, I actually wanted to backtrack a little bit because I know that there's a whole field of economics dedicated to the fact that we're not totally rational beings, but tipping seems very irrational. Like someone has set a price for something and then we all collectively decide to pay more for it. So why do we tip?
Yeah, it's really funny you say that because there was some old research that was done. At one point, the theory was that if I tip, you're going to reciprocate. Mm-hmm. So if I live in a community and I'm nice to other people, then the next time I encounter them, they're going to give me better service. But they did all this research and they found that people did things like tip in taxi cabs in New York. You're never seeing that cab driver again.
Right.
That makes
There's no incentive for me.
Yeah. Right. So since that time, there's been research that shows that tipping does a bunch of different things. One of the things that it does is it's supposed to give feedback, right? So if somebody asks us what we think, we like to say what we think. This is a way to express that. But it also acts as a signal to ourselves, right? Like you said, we want to see ourselves as generous people. We want to see ourselves as appreciative people. So the action gives us an opportunity to say something about who we are to the people around us and to ourselves.
I'm massaging my own
ego. Yes, right, exactly. Like most of the time, which is what we're doing. So you have these two functions that are going on, right? Like giving feedback and giving rewards and punishments and things like that, which makes us feel like we're in control of the situation, and also saying, this is who I am.
So, and you just said the word control, because a lot of people are now saying it has gotten out of control.
Yep.
And so I want you to sort of take us back pre-pandemic. How was it? And then how did the pandemic sort of shift everything? Because now it feels like we have no control over this tipping thing.
Right. So it's funny. You can look back and find, you know, now that we've had the internet for a while, you can find articles that were written in 2008, 2014, when people were saying, you should never tip. Tipping is stupid, right? So people, there's been an undercurrent of objection for a long time because there have been always people who say that's priced into the product, right? I'm already paying for it. The tip is not necessary. During the pandemic, though, I think many of us became more acutely aware of the economic pressures that people were experiencing, particularly people in service industries that were reliant on face-to-face interaction. And I think at that point, tipping took on this extra dimension of, you know, of signaling that we care about these people and that we want to support them and that we're glad that they're working, even though it's putting themselves at risk. So we started, I think you saw this upswell of empathy coming through in tipping, and a real appreciation, particularly when companies were trying to hire again, for the people that were coming back for work. It was a sincere appreciation. Thank you for being here so I can go to a restaurant, because you know, otherwise, what am I going to eat? But now, okay, we're in this new normal state. The question is, how long does that empathy last? Is that empathy necessary? Did firms actually raise wages such that we don't feel the need to do this? Has inflation raised the prices of the goods and services themselves so much that there's no room for a tip on top of that, right? That it should already be included. So we've had this interesting cycle. And I do think we're in a place that we haven't been before because we have this hangover from the time when it was a real, I think it was in many cases a real act of empathy and connection for people.
as tipping becomes more widespread, or if it becomes more widespread, who are the winners and losers? Because I have heard the argument that we're kind of just subsidizing the boss's employee costs by tipping on top of whatever wage the person is making, kind of letting them off the hook. So that's a bit of framing, but I do want just generally, like who are the winners and losers in this scenario?
It clearly shifts cost, right? If an employee knows that they're working at a restaurant where tips tend to be high, then it places less pressure on the employer to stabilize their income. In a very practical sense, the biggest winners are often going to be the people who provide the lowest cost goods proportionately, because that's where, you know, if you have a $3 cup of coffee and you throw a dollar on there, which means it seems minimal, that's a big win relative to zero. Proportionately, that's where the biggest gain is going to be.
Interesting.
And if you are just tuning in, we are speaking with Kate Lamberton, marketing professor at the University of Pennsylvania. We're talking about when to tip, how much to tip, and when you can skip it. And we want to hear from you. Are you confused or annoyed by tipping requests? Call us. The number is 888-477-9499. You can also email us at studio2@whyy.org. So I wanted to talk about the amount, because I don't even know how you determine how much to give. Like, there's 15%, 20%. Some people say 30% now. And you know, how do you even determine an amount, and should it necessarily be tied to the cost of the product, or should you just say, here's $2?
Yeah, some of this is between you and your own soul, right? So there's that, right? But one thing I will say that I think is rational. In this country, about 8% of the coinage that's created each year ends up in the landfill, right? It's something like $62 million, right? We don't use our coins. Those coins, for most of us, are going to end up shoved somewhere under a couch cushion. There is not much reason for us to keep those coins. So if you're paying with cash and you end up with change, unless you're a person who's really scrupulous about using it, consider that that change is more likely to go to use if you go ahead and throw it in the tip jar. So that's minimal, right? Beyond that, though, I think we do have to be a little bit careful, because if you give a very small tip, we did some research years ago that shows that it's actually more insulting than giving no tip at all. So, right, even though objectively, yes, a quarter is more than zero, people say that's all it's worth. So you actually trivialize their effort because you've given such a small tip, and you say, that's all it counts for. So you have to be a little bit careful, aside from just not throwing your change
away. So my goal is to not be judged by the person.
Well, that's part of it too. It is a signal, right? It is, at the end of this day, this isn't a human interaction, right? I think when you mentioned the swivel pad where they have the three different categories, a lot of that was driven by research that was done that showed the incredible power of the middle option. Yes. That, you know, when something is in the middle, we're like, well, that must be the reasonable choice. That's what I'm going to do. But what I noticed coming right from the airport the other day was that it was 20, 25%, 30%.
Yep.
And if I wanted to give 15, I was actually going to have to back out.
It does feel like, though,
put some effort into it, right?
That brings up a larger point, which is feels like this technology that we use now at the point of customer service is like hacking our brain and sort of tapping into our sense of what's fair, our sense of shame, our sense of guilt, very effectively over and over and over again. What do we know about this technology that seems to be more and more prevalent at the point of service?
Yeah, I mean, these people have become very good behavioral scientists, so to speak. You know, they've read the books. They got it. and it works. It does communicate to us. And it also takes away friction. So it's really easy. You know, some people's response is, well, you know, I'll use cash, which is interesting in two ways. First of all, usually paying with cash is higher friction, so you think more about the money that you spend. But it also takes the technology out of the picture. But again, for most of us, that's a pain, right? Yeah. And we've gotten ourselves to the point where we like just swiping our phone or swiping our card. So that's a big ask to say, well, I would to avoid paying 5% more in a tip, I'm going to re-engineer my entire way of working in the market. That's a lot.
Most people aren't going to do that.
No, they're not going to.
I want to talk about the psychology of it. And I want to bring in this comment from one of our listeners, Nancy, who said, "It's gotten out of hand. I bought ice cream and the owner of the store said, quote, how much of a tip would you like to leave? It really caught me off guard. She says, I left $1 on a $3 ice cream and he was the owner. You should not have to tip the owners of the place." I want to talk about, because we even said the person is like staring you down, right? And, you know, and there was, you know, there was a survey that said women are more likely to tip than men and all this stuff. So when you see someone looking you in the eye, and it could be the little pad, it could be cash. Talk about the psychology, the peer pressure of having you feel like you almost have to tip.
Yeah, we have very strong social norms about not saying no. And women are particularly susceptible to those social norms. And it's not just about money. It's about a lot of things. That if you someone asks you for something, often we won't even ask for things unless we're pretty sure somebody's going to say yes. Mm. Because we don't even want to be told no, right? And so when somebody asks, if they're likely to ask, people are the likelihood of compliance is pretty high. In fact, to not comply, you've got to have a reason. And so if you're caught in that moment, you're not going to be able to come up with a socially acceptable reason why you're not going to give that person a dollar, right? And if you were in that environment, it's going to be a very awkward conversation. Like, well, no, sir, I think you own the ice cream store, so I don't think you deserve it. Okay, that becomes a much longer conversation.
Good luck getting ice cream somewhere else, right? By the way.
But then you're scared that if you ever come back,
Now, I think some of us have had the experience, for example, where, say, you have a car that someone's parking for you, right? And you don't have cash. This happens to me all the time because I never have cash. What we also found in that research about the very small thank yous is that a really sincere thank you actually goes a long way. Like, rather than saying, here's 25 cents because that's what I have in my cup holder of my car, if you say, no, right now I don't have any cash, I'm so sorry, but I really appreciate what you did. It makes a big difference that you did it for me. We don't want to, you know, you don't want to become a stingy person. But if there's a case where giving a tip really isn't within your financial means or really doesn't feel appropriate to you, it's okay to thank people in a way that means something.
We are talking with Kate Lamberton, marketing professor at University of Pennsylvania, talking about tipping and tipping etiquette. If you want to join the conversation, the number is 888-477-9499. You can also email us, studio2@whyy.org. Going to bring in caller Tim right now, who wants to talk about the bigger forces behind this issue. I wonder what that means. Tim, what is your question or comment? You are on Studio 2.
Thank you. My comment is, this is just another example of a systemic issue that's being pushed onto people to figure out. So we're made to make personal choices, you know, personal sacrifices to address a bigger systemic issue, which is, you know, unfair wages, you know, not enough of a minimum wage. And I think that I'm tired of having to make those decisions. It feels like a lot after the pandemic having to do that.
That's really interesting. And it gets in, Tim mentioned wages. I mean, restaurant workers need tips. They're not paid a living wage. They're not even paid the very low minimum wage. So tips are their livelihood. Can you talk about some of the systemic issues or the cracks, really, that tipping is filling?
Yeah, it's a stopgap. And this is, I think you're exactly right, Tim. We have a lot of these that we see in marketing. The term that we use is responsabilization, right? And it means that you make the person that is actually, you know, at the lowest, most direct level responsible for things far above. And in a sense, I think people object to that because they say, if I do the thing that my moral sense tells me to do, I'm actually allowing this problem to persist over time. And we don't want to do that. But at the same time, the signal that we send to ourselves when we look someone in the eye and say, no, I'm not giving you a tip, that's pretty hard to carry. And so you're right. It's something that, you know, in an ideal world, we can all come to agreement about what this should be and take this out of the system. If you look at a place like Denmark, you don't tip in Denmark because everyone in that society has, at least, you know, at an aggregate level, agreed that people should be paid a living wage and we shouldn't need to do this. In the U.S., we don't have that system. And so I think your point is well taken. It still leaves us with the question of every day what we are meant to do. And you know, do we keep carrying this along, or do we actually have to push it to a point where where people, you know, can't make a livelihood and then vote a different way, and then we see that change? That's going to be a long, slow journey. But I think the point is very well taken.
So I want to get down to some practicalities.
Yeah.
Okay. And, you know, you could say tip or skip.
Yeah.
Okay. I want to ask you some scenarios, and I have a few here. Avi, you can add in and throw here. Because I get my hair. I'm a person who loves to get my hair done. We get the hair done, haircuts. Tip or skip?
Tip.
Coffee shop barista.
I tend to tip.
Tip. Bartender.
Oh, of course you tip.
Tip. You want to throw something in there?
What do you want something to happen?
Well, obviously, restaurant wait staff definitely tip.
Yeah.
I mean, is there an example of one, though, that you would skip, or one you think that has become? Because here's my worry is that people get tip fatigue, and then they don't tip the people who need the tips.
Yes.
And so I think on some level you have to draw a line. So do you have a sense of where to draw that line?
Yeah. I mean, I think there are cases where what's being provided really is a commodity, and the service that's being provided is not being provided by the person who's receiving the tips. So, for example, I went into my dry cleaner, and there was a tip jar. I was like, well, if I were giving the tip to the people who actually dry clean my clothes, I'd feel differently about it. But as far as I can tell, that tip jar is going to the person who's checking me out. And I'm not sure that's really the service that's being provided, right, or that there's any variation in that service.
Right.
Right. I think, and again, I do think that the pressure is, or not pressure, but the obligation is a bit stronger when you see someone all the time. So the person that does your hair, that's an ongoing relationship.
And maybe if you have cleaners, maybe yes, a plumber. David asked, in New Jersey, you don't pump your own gas. My question is, should you be tipping this person?
You know, I don't know if I do that right or wrong. I feel like I
don't know.
That's fair. I mean, I think sometimes we think about giving money in a lot of different ways. And when we think about charity, we often evaluate it in terms of how much good it's going to do.
Yeah.
And for me, the calculation that I often do is how much difference is it going to make to me as opposed to how much difference is it going to make for somebody else, right? And that makes it pretty clear for me. Like an extra 5% for me, I'm going to fortunate enough position that 5% on my coffee isn't going to make a big difference for me. Maybe for other people it will. And that's even more reason that if I can do it, I feel like I'm going to do it.
Interesting.
But other people who can't, I think they get to make that choice. And hopefully we make up for each other somewhere in the middle.
Can I get an email here from Bobby? 40 years ago, my husband told me that servers often don't get the entire amount if you add it to the credit card. So he tipped in cash, which I mostly still do. We asked servers in a few restaurants at that time and they concurred. Do you know if this is still true? And I would also point out in these new point of service tablets that those companies are taking a cut when you tip as well. Yeah. So when you tip, who gets the money?
Yeah, it does get split. I mean, even often servers have to tip out the hostesses and the hosts, and that's been that way for a long time, right? So they don't necessarily get the whole tip anyway. But yeah, there are cuts that are taken all along the way, right? So, you know, if we had the option to sit and split it out and say, well, you can have this and you can have this, I don't know that the time would be worth it for us to do it.
Right.
So you kind of have to put it out in the world and hope that it gets where you want it to go.
I just wanted to squeeze in there. If you're going on vacation and when do, just a quick tip on how to determine whether or not you tip.
I would look it up before you go. I was in South Korea a few weeks ago and I learned you do not tip there.
Yeah.
If you tip, it's a very small amount, mostly as an act of convenience. They're like, yes, we'll take that extra change off your hands. But I would look it up.
Every country is different on this.
Mm-hmm. Yes.
We just spoke with Kate Lamberton, professor of marketing at the University of Pennsylvania, all about tipping. Kate, it was a wonderful conversation.
Yes.
Thank you for being on Studio 2.
Thank you, guys. I'll leave your tip at the door.
Oh, thank you.
You had that locked and loaded. Stick with us on Studio 2. We are talking about an academic legend coming up.
Supporting WHYY, Penn Medicine, helping to find new cures for cancer. With life-saving clinical trials and advanced surgical techniques, Penn Medicine is offering more hope for patients everywhere. Learn more at PennMedicine.org/cancer. Penn Medicine, what's next?
At a time when information continues to come at us faster and faster, sometimes you need to hit pause and rewind. NPR's Throughline takes you back in time to the source of the news stories filling your feed. Find NPR's Throughline wherever you get your podcasts.
And welcome back to Studio 2. I'm Avi Wolfman-Arendt.
And I'm Cherry Gregg.
Earlier this month, Charles L. Bloxon died at the age of 89. The Norristown native was a renowned scholar, author, and activist who amassed one of the largest private collections of African-American historical items in the world. He had books, manuscripts, photographs, pamphlets, sheet music, and more, with materials dating back to 1581.
Wow. And Bloxon donated his collection to Temple University in 1984, but continued his scholarship and collecting. Today, the Charles L. Bloxon Afro-American Collection has 700,000 items and is used by students, community members, and historians from across the country. Here to tell us more about Charles Bloxon, where his interest in preserving the history of Black Americans came from, and some of his most treasured finds, is curator of the collection, Diane Turner. Welcome to Studio 2, Diane.
Thank you for having me here.
So one of the things that fascinated me about Dr. Bloxon was the origin story of his love for collecting historical artifacts from African Americans. And it all started in Norristown when he was in grade school. Can you tell that story?
Okay, well, it was in 1943. But one of the things that happened before that, his father was a collector. Mm. So he used to go to places with him. He collected antiques and also books. So in 1943, when he raised his hand and he asked his teacher, who was a substitute teacher, what contributions had Negroes made to American history? He said, later on when I asked him, he said her thinking was with the times. So he was very hurt about it when she told him, Charles, Negroes have no history and it's their place to serve whites. So with that, it basically fueled his lifetime pursuit of collecting. He had been exposed from his father, from Richard Wright writing and so forth. So whenever he got any allowance or monetary gifts, he would purchase anything that had colored, Negro, Ethiopian, Jamaican, Egyptian, you name it. And that's one of the greatest things about the Bloxon collection, is the fact that usually when people come there, we have such a range of materials that relate to people of African descent. They're just very happy and overwhelmed, because our librarian is Laku Brahanu. She always surprises them with more than they could imagine that would be in the Bloxon collection.
How did he do it? I mean, this was not someone who was born into great means. You know, sometimes you hear about bibliophiles and they inherit a huge amount of money from their family and they spend that, you know, collecting pieces of art or books. I mean, how was he able, where did he go to find this stuff, and how was he able to collect so much of it?
Okay, so really, and he talked about that to me, because he says, you know, like later on, I actually was his graduate assistant at Temple when I was working on my PhD. And he would say, you know, people would call and they would want to be close to him. And he said, they don't realize the struggle I had to go through, because basically he took all of his own money to purchase these things. But the teacher's thinking was with the times. So, you know, whenever he got any allowance or anything, he would go to bookstores, used bookstores, Salvation Army, Goodwill. And because there was this belief that Negroes had no history, he said sometimes he would go into a bookstore. If he didn't have enough money to purchase the book, he would just hide it on the shelf and come back later. Of course, you know, now, you know, to buy some of the things that he got, it would cost you thousands of dollars. But back then, you know, he was able to accumulate these things because that's what he wanted to spend his money on. And he even said when he was at Penn State, Josh Culbreth and Rosie Greer were his roommates at one point.
This is the great football player, Rosie Greer.
Exactly. Yeah. And he said, you know, after games, when they would go to the parties, he would meet them later because whatever town they were in, he would go to the bookstores, you know? Wow. And so, you know, it was just something he had a passion for.
It was a 24/7 thing.
Yeah. And, you know, like he said, I would sit in his office sometimes and he said, "Fill this." He loved the feel of the books, the smell of it, you know, all of that. You know, he would just had that passion.
And he collected because he that story happened. He was 9 years old at the time.
Yes.
He was 89 when he recently passed. 80 years of collecting. And one of the things that caught my eye was the he had a Harriet Tubman signed hymnal, as well as a shawl she received from Queen Victoria that he donated to the Smithsonian. Can you talk about some of the beautiful things he had that you think were like very, very special like that?
Okay, let's talk about the Harriet Tubman, because he had retired in 2006. I came there in 2007 after they did a national search. And in 2010, he calls me up all excited. He said, "You won't believe this, Diane." I said, "What, Mr. Blockins? What's going on?" He said, "Merle Wilkins, the great niece of Harriet Tubman, I just got a call from her lawyer." I said, "Oh, okay." She bequeathed me 39 personal items of Harriet Tubman's. Mm. And I said, "Well, wow, what are you going to do? Are you going to bring them to the Bloxon collection? Are they going to be part of the..." He said, "Diane, relax. I'm going to pray on it."
Uh-huh.
And so a couple of days later, he called me and he said, "Well, I took the materials and I put them in my safety deposit box, but I was uncomfortable, so I got them out of there and they're in a safe place now." I said, "Well, where are they, Mr. Bloxon?" He said, "Under my bed."
Hmm.
You know, so then another few days later, he said, "Listen, I'm going to donate the materials to the National Museum of African American History and Culture of the Smithsonian, because Harriet Tubman was such an international person." Mm-hmm. And so I said, "Oh, that's great, but it's Women's History Month now. Can you bring the materials and have them on display for one day?" And he said yes. So he brought the materials down, and it was just amazing, you know, because here's this woman, Harriet Tubman, called the Moses of her people. She was a spy, you know. She went into the South to liberate others, and to see her personal items like an embroidered collar, you know, it was just so touching, because you know, like, as a Black woman, you know, sometimes you have to be really tough and you have to do these things, but she still had this very feminine side to her. And so, you know, and then Queen Victoria's shawl was also there. And we were invited to the national, well, he was invited to the opening.
Mm-hmm.
And we went down there, and as Laku and I were going through the exhibit, we saw it. It's prominently displayed. And speaking of books, we were very excited because all the rare books they had, we have in the Bloxon collection, like Phyllis Wheatley's 1773 edition of her poems, David Walker's Appeal, Nat Turner, first editions of Frederick Douglass, you name it. We have all those items. We have over 5,000 rare books.
And it's all there at the Charles L. Bloxon Afro-American Collection at Temple University. You've been hearing from curator Diane Turner. Thank you so much for joining us today on Studio 2.
Thank you.
That is it for our show today. Tune in tomorrow for another hour of Studio 2. Our producers are Debbie Builder, Paige Marie Bessler, and Andreas Copes. Charlie Kyer is our engineer from Studio 2 at WHYY in Philadelphia. I'm Avi Wolfman-Arendt.
And I'm Cherry Gregg. Thank you so much for joining us today.